Here's what's coming up in the Category5.tv newsroom. Microsoft no longer sees PlayStation maker Sony and Nintendo as the biggest competition for its Xbox platform, and you won't believe who they see as their biggest threat. An artist tricked Google into thinking that there were major traffic jams by pulling a wagon filled with smartphones down empty streets. ARM is getting edgy with two new processor designs, which bring slimline AI workloads to smart speakers and other Internet of Things devices. And Windows Trust and Abandoned Driver Code lets ransomware burrow deep into targeted machines. Stick around, the full details are coming up later in the show.
This is the Category5.tv newsroom, covering the week's top tech stories with a slight Linux bias.
I'm Sasha Rickman, joined this week by Jeff Weston and Robbie Ferguson.
Some quick honorable mentions this week. A hacker crew managed to temporarily take control of Facebook's official Twitter account. The irony. In a tweet posted on February 7th at 3:50 p.m. on the official @Facebook Twitter feed, the attacker posted, "Hi, we are OurMine. Well, even Facebook is hackable, but at least their security better than Twitter." They then went on to advertise their services, saying to contact them in order to, quote, "improve your account security," unquote. OurMine did not say how they got into the social network's Twitter account, but no self-respecting hacker would ever pass up the opportunity to blast Facebook's security practices. According to a draft research paper from the astronomers who are analyzing it, a mysterious radio signal from space that was first detected in Canada appears to repeat at regular 16-day intervals. The unusual signal, which has been traced back to a spiral galaxy roughly 500 million light years from Earth, is known as a fast radio burst, aka FRB. It has been fascinating astronomers since Canada's Chime telescope first detected it in 2018. Scientists have discovered hundreds of seemingly random one-off FRBs over the last decade, but only a handful of them have been found to repeat. Now, here's the thing. This particular signal is not only repeating, but it appears to be sent out at regular intervals. The signal starts, and let me just say, this is not sci-fi, this is really reality. The signal starts every 16.35 days. It lasts for 4 days and then falls silent for 12 days before starting up again. According to the paper, that is a recurring schedule. The number of bursts within each 4-day blast varied each time according to 409 days worth of data that was compiled by Chime. The study authors say in their abstract, quote, "Our results suggest a mechanism for periodic modulation and disfavor models invoking purely sporadic processes." In other words, and this is not a quote, so the quote is over. But in other words, the signal is not repeating at random, okay? So they say that the source may be flickering at regular intervals, or some other factor might be interrupting the signal blasts in a consistent pattern. Orbits come to mind for me, like that could be part of it for sure. But if their findings are confirmed, the discovery would be another first in the early study of FRBs, which have only been known to science for a relatively short period of time. Called the ultimate ARM-powered NAS, Helios 64 is accepting pre-orders discounted for the first 500. Helios 64 is a full-fledged Linux-powered NAS solution that offers built-in features that you will not find in any other product at this price point. It supports up to 80 terabytes of data storage in 5 hot-swappable drive bays, plus support for a single M.2 for applications that demand extra performance. For connectivity, It uses the new multi-gigabit speed standard on dual LAN ports. They offer up to 2.5 gigabits per second throughput. The NAS uses an ARM64 hexa-core SoC. It features 4 gigabytes of RAM and a 16 gigabyte eMMC for OS storage and booting. Now, it's a NAS that's basically behaving like a Linux computer. So because the Helio 64 is open source, once it's released, we're going to begin seeing distributions created specifically for this hardware. The Helio 64 was slated for release as early as next month, but with factory shutdowns due to the coronavirus, the first shipments will be delayed. An ETA update will be provided by the company once factory lines are allowed to reopen in China, but we estimate it to be late spring or possibly early summer. Pre-orders are discounted to just, are you ready for this? $285 to the first 500 orders. And you can place that order now at cobol.io.
Let's get into the top stories we're following this week. Microsoft no longer sees PlayStation maker Sony and Nintendo as the biggest competition for its Xbox platform. Phil Spencer, Microsoft's head of gaming, said he now considered Amazon and Google as his top rivals because of their cloud computing infrastructure. He believes their traditional rivals, Nintendo and Sony, are out of step with the future of gaming. He said, quote, "When you talk about Nintendo and Sony, we have a ton of respect for them, but we see Amazon and Google as the main competitors going forward. That's not to disrespect Nintendo and Sony, but the traditional gaming companies are somewhat out of position," end quote. With cloud gaming, players don't need to buy a games console. Instead, the games are run on servers in huge data centers with the footage streamed over the internet to a TV, computer, smartphone, or a tablet. It means players don't need to buy discs or download games and software updates, which can take a long time. Google entered the home gaming market in 2019 with its Stadia streaming service. The company's vast cloud computing business means that it has the necessary infrastructure in place, but critics say the lineup of games on Stadia is currently sparse. While Amazon and Apple offer games on their app stores and Apple offers a monthly subscription, they don't currently offer a cloud gaming service. However, Amazon also operates an enormous cloud computing business and is rumored to be developing a game service. Sony has offered its PlayStation Now cloud gaming service since 2014, letting gamers stream more than 700 titles to a PS4 console or PC. However, it currently streams games in 720p resolution. By contrast, Google Stadia can stream its games at up to 4K resolution. NVIDIA has officially launched its GeForce Now streaming service after months of testing, and both Sony and Microsoft have already announced that they are still working on new games consoles for home.
Totally demonstrates the shift in how things are being, how technology is being provisioned.
I feel old, I guess, in the fact that my brain doesn't get it. Like, I don't understand. Like, I'm still really locked into consoles.
Well, it's mind-bending. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've been sold for so many years that the biggest, most powerful console is going to give you the best gaming experience. Now we're being told, oh, well, you can do it on your phone. You can do it on this little $100 device. You can do it on anything. Oh, and then you can transition over to your computer, which doesn't even have to be a good computer. It can be a Chromebook.
Yeah. Right.
What?
I think the difference, though, and I mean, admittedly, I have not explored Google and Amazon's gaming services, so I can't speak from firsthand knowledge.
Sure.
But the ability to go offline is what separates the two.
Oh, okay. Yes.
But maybe that's the idea, is that we're never offline anymore. Well, and sure we are, but do we really? But when we're at that point, it's just, we're always connected, Jeff.
But that
we're
is
always connected these days.
You're right. We are always connected, but that's
5G, 6G.
But that's an assumption of necessary connectivity. Like, we see this with our kids all the time. Mm-hmm. They play games that are not online. Mm-hmm. It's downloaded, and that's it. Like,
sure, yeah.
Minecraft is a great one for kids that are younger, where they're playing Minecraft. It's not going online. I mean, you could go to Realms and stuff, but the difference here is,
yeah,
if you're going to go with the cloud-based computer gaming services, you're stuck to a couple of things. You're stuck to what they offer, mm-hmm. from the choices and the graphics and all that kind of stuff, which I think, again, I don't know from firsthand, would be subpar compared to what you can pull out of, say, you know, an Xbox One S or, you know, PlayStation 5 with yeah. their graphics. I mean, I can't see playing like Red Dead Redemption 2 on my phone.
You can't You're see it because you right. haven't seen it yet.
Let me just say,
okay. still,
it's from the technological perspective,
everything's going cloud.
Yes, but the quality. So you're saying, will it look as good? So the quality is not the video. The video is my TV is 1080p, so it's 1920 by 1080p, regardless of how powerful my system is or right. not. So yet, for some reason, if I use a first gen Wii versus a PlayStation 4, mm-hmm. I'm going to notice a quality difference in the PlayStation. And sure, it's a different system, and so it is apples right. to oranges. But what I mean is, the power of that more powerful system, even though my TV never changed resolution, it's still the same resolution. The video quality is still the same.
Right.
Okay? But it looks so much better because that one is so much more powerful. So now take that and put it into a cloud server, where this cloud server is still streaming 1920 by 1080p mm-hmm. to my 1080p TV. Mm-hmm. And yet it has so much power. Yes. Like, it's a multi-billion-dollar system versus my little $400
right.
console, right? So the resolution is not the bottleneck now. Our internet is capable of streaming 4K video in real time with no latency.
Right.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. So now put a back end in there that is so powerful that I can do that on my cheap device.
Yeah.
And on any device, and I can transition from device to device. I don't have to buy anything in particular to be able to use my yes. games.
And the transition is happening, but the transition is going to be difficult for people like me who still like to go to the store and buy a game. And yeah. and I actually kind of
And if they go out of business, you take it with you and put it on. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
I hesitate even buying digital copies of games. Yeah. Like, I like to have the actual game, mm-hmm. but I understand that the future is coming up quick. Mm-hmm. I'm still going to buy a PS5, sure. but I'm going to also likely play games on Stadia.
Right. Yeah. And that's an interesting point. I want to just reiterate what you just said, which is I'm going to also play video games yes. on Stadia. So I don't think that we're replacing that offline phone device. I think we're supplementing it and saying,
yeah, an enhancement.
Hey, now, okay, you can also, when you're connected to the internet, play games that you can't play when you're offline that are like high end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where, okay, maybe this is just another platform. We all have multiple platforms.
Well, they have that for
right?
VR. I wonder if they'll have like,
now, here's,
I don't know. The latency is too high for VR.
Here's the question I would have.
It's got to be able to track you.
With this.
Right now.
So, I mean, like, you've brought up VR, which, you know, totally
That's
makes
in
sense.
In the far future, I suppose. Yes.
What about things like frame rate? Like, as you said,
60p, you know, 4K, that's pretty good to me.
No, but I hear you. But you're talking about the screen resolution. I mean, if your internet can't keep up, it's going to impact your gameplay.
Sure.
Do you remember yeah. when it used to be like, oh, I'm lagging so bad?
Yeah.
Like, is this opening yeah. the door to go back to lagging? Are my kids going to go, what is
yes.
lagging?
However, consider this as, and I know we do need to move on to the next story, yeah. but consider that the very companies that are pushing the technology shift are the same companies who are controlling the introduction of like Google's gigabit fiber to the home.
Right.
Right. So
yeah,
if that's so you know, it's going to perform well. It's like, you just know that that's what they're driving toward, and they're not going to build a service that's going to fail based on that.
This
latency is a big thing.
Sure.
For sure.
Yeah. And because this is internet based, it's going to resolve the cross platform compatibility issues.
It's an interesting thing, though, because you have to remember that this is not game streaming. This is video streaming.
Mm-hmm.
We've already proven through YouTube and through everything else that video streaming is great these days.
Yep.
There's no latency on videos, like really in real time, if it was real time. So they've created real time video streaming service that has the interactivity of controls.
Mm-hmm.
And a control doesn't take a lot of bandwidth.
No.
So it's like, it's instant as long as you don't have high pings.
Right.
As long as you don't have latency on your internet connection. And that's the key thing. And so they'll be driving ISPs to support their codecs, and we'll see an evolution in that kind of thing.
It's gonna be
interesting. We're in it like a cuspy kind of time now. Yeah. Very cool.
If you've tried Stadia or any other cloud-based service, comment below. Let us know if you've been contemplating it. Maybe post why you haven't tried it yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's holding you up?
Artist Simon Weckert noticed something unusual at a May Day demonstration in Berlin. Google Maps showed that there was a massive traffic jam, even though there were zero cars on the road. Soon enough, Wicket realized that it was the mass of people, or more specifically, their smartphones, that had inadvertently tricked Google into seeing gridlock on an empty street. And then he decided to do it himself. Weckert says, quote, "The question was if it might be possible to generate something like this in a much simpler way. I don't need the people. I just need their smartphones," end quote. So he borrowed phones from friends and rental companies until he had acquired 99 devices, which he piled into a little red wagon. The plan was simple. Over the course of a day, Weckert would walk up and down a given street, mostly at random, towing his smartphone-packed wagon behind him. The effect wasn't instantaneous. It took Google Maps about an hour to catch up. But eventually, inevitably, Weckert said that his wagon would create a huge, long red line in the app, indicating that a traffic had slowed to a crawl, even though there wasn't any traffic at all. He had effectively tricked the system into thinking a series of large buses was crawling back and forth. Google said in a statement, quote, "Traffic data in Google Maps is refreshed continuously thanks to information from a variety of sources, including aggregated and anonymized data from people who have location services turned on and contributions from the Google Maps community," end quote. They note that while it had figured out how to distinguish between cars and motorcycles, it does not yet have any way to filter for a Weckert's setup. Weckert says, quote, "What I'm really interested in generally is the connection between technology and society and the impact of technology, how it shapes us," end quote. The hack is getting attention, not only because it's fun, but also serves as a necessary reminder that the systems people take for granted involve inputs and outputs, and that they themselves are sometimes both. It shows how simple it is to fool a product in which people place a tremendous amount of trust.
That is interesting. That's a lot of fun. But I love how the artist has found the spin to say, hey, maybe we're trusting the technology a little too much, that so much so that anyone looking at their app or using their GPS that's powered by Google services is avoiding those areas based on his little experiment.
Right. So when I had first heard the story, I thought to myself, okay, so four people are in a car. Like if you're carpooling and you're stuck in a slow section of the highway, is it going to show up way busier on the highway than it actually is? It's completely,
That's nuts.
I personally use Waze, which is owned by Google.
I think it's the exact same.
Well, no, there's some enhanced features that Google Maps doesn't have.
It's spelled differently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But what I like about Waze is that it is user input, unlike a lot of Google Maps that is drawn by anonymous user data and things happening in the back end. So Waze builds off Google Maps, but then you can add your individual components into it. But I have at times had a phone call or a text or something come in where it's like, I need to respond to this. So I'll pull over on the side of the road, do the thing that I need to do. And all of a sudden I get an alert on my phone. We're detecting a slowdown.
Oh,
you know, are you in traffic? How heavy is the traffic? And I'm like, no, I'm not.
I'm busy.
I'm pulled over. And so I'll say no. and move on.
They're this is odd. Jeff is not texting while driving.
No, I follow the rules. This is out of character for you. I follow the rules. But what I could have done is gone, yes, heavy traffic.
Sure.
Traffic's flowing beside me. But so, I mean, there is that user element. So I've never fully trusted the information I see on those services because I know that there is that user input data.
Right. Actually, today on my way to the studio, I always use Google Maps. I, even though I know how to get here, I always use it. I like to be told what to do. But Google told me to take the highway, and I looked at the highway and I thought, that's a dead stop. And Google was pretty mad at me. Like, it kept trying to direct me back to the highway, but I was like, I am taking the main road.
Was it just that one spot? And then it was fine after?
I don't know.
Yeah, there's one spot on the highway right now. But okay, so this opens up something, though, interesting about, and I know we need to move to the next story, but about proximity. How specific is location-based services on the phone? Because, like, my kids play Pokemon Go.
Yeah.
So when they're at home, if they move from one side of the living room to the next, their character moves with them.
Yeah.
But when I'm sitting in the car, I'm getting a bigger blip on the map. And so I don't know if it can update as quick to my precise location.
It's probably lulling you into a false sense of like anonymity. It knows exactly where you are. It knows exactly where you're parked.
So then could Google have not built something into the programming that it watches for the collection of devices? And it goes, there are 99 within this box. That's not actual.
I think they will
I
now,
I think they're
Jeff.
Working on that in this present moment. So
it is something
they
can
saw
do.
Him coming.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. The wagon foiled us again.
Okay, we have got to take a quick break. More of this week's top tech stories are coming up. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. Announced the Ethos U55 and the Cortex M55 for edge devices, bringing an AI neural network accelerator to future smart speakers, light bulbs, fridges, and other IoT devices. The more powerful of the two, known as the Cortex M55, is a general microcontroller grade CPU blueprint. While the other, named Ethos U55, is essentially an AI accelerator. The Cortex M55 is based on ARM's Helium technology. The Ethos U55, on the other hand, is a novel architecture for ARM and has been described as a micro neural processing unit, or micro NPU for short. Both processors are available now to license and are intended to be used together. The M55 running application code, the U55 doing all the neural network mathematics in fast hardware. The senior director of the IoT and embedded team at ARM says, quote, the micro NPU cannot be used on its own. It needs to be paired with a CPU like the Cortex M55. Together, this system delivers 480 times the performance compared to previous Cortex M generations working on their own, end quote. We expect to see chips using these blueprints early next year.
Awesome. I can't believe this is real life that neural processing units are now a part of an SoC. Like, this is so it's just sci-fi to my 1980s mind.
Like, I remember when, which Star Trek was it where they use the neural packs?
Neural packs?
What are they called? Oh my gosh. One of the Star Treks, was it Enterprise maybe? Where there's like a...
Oh, to have like telepresence?
Yeah, within the ship, and like they would blow out and they'd have to replace them. And there were like these gel pack things. And I'm like, that would never happen. Oh, okay. I think it was Star Trek.
Don't think that's what this is,
Jeff. No, I understand. No, I understand that. But I remember watching that. I think it was Star Trek Enterprise. And I was like, there's no way we're going to have that kind of advanced technology. It's not possible. And this is like 15, 20 years ago. And now I'm watching stuff like this where it's like neural networks. I'm like, oh my goodness. Every year there's a new possibility. And I never would have expected this.
This is,
Like,
so we're talking like the next gen of AI.
Which is so crazy.
That these little chips can now process teraflops worth of information. Like it's, I don't know what it really is, but it's like ridiculous amounts of data having to do with AI.
Right.
So that the next thing is that, you know, coders will be able to make thinking devices. So those smart speakers with this technology will be smarter.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is the fact that they're two separate things. Like, I'm surprised that
they don't have to have a CPU. You have to have the ability to run traditional code.
Yeah.
Right.
Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to, as a human, interact with it.
Yeah.
There has to be a layer for humans to be able to access the NPU.
Yeah. That...
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it'd just blow our minds.
How quickly before this would be adapted for phones? And
well, we already have AI technology in phones.
Right. But I mean, at this level.
I don't know.
Like, because that could change mobile computing.
Sure. It's going to change a lot of stuff.
Oh, it's going to be
wild. But that's the idea, is that it's getting faster, smaller,
yeah,
and more integrated. That's the way technology goes. And so we're seeing a massive shift in how data is processed, because we're specifically looking toward AI.
We're not far
and machine learning.
From a Jarvis, mm-hmm, in our little glasses.
Attackers behind one of the world's more destructive pieces of ransomware have found a new way to defeat defenses that might otherwise prevent the attack from encrypting data, installing a buggy driver first and then hacking it to burrow deeper into the targeted computer. The ransomware in this case is Robinhood, known for taking down the City of Baltimore networks and systems in Greenville, North Carolina. Robinhood can easily encrypt sensitive files once a vulnerability has allowed the malware to gain a toehold. For networks that are better fortified, the ransomware has a harder time breaking in. Now, Robinhood has found a way to defeat these defenses. In two recent attacks, researchers from security firm Sophos said the ransomware has used its access to a targeted machine to install a driver from Taiwan-based motherboard manufacturer Gigabyte that has a known vulnerability in it. It's the same vulnerability that led to Gigabyte officials discontinuing the use of the driver. But since it contains Gigabyte's cryptographic signature, the Windows operating system trusts it and allows it to run in the highly sensitive Windows kernel region of the OS without question. With the benign but buggy driver installed, Robinhood then exploited the vulnerability to gain the ability to read and write to virtually any memory region chosen by the attacker. The Robinhood exploit changed a single byte to disable the Windows requirement that drivers be signed. With that, Robinhood installed its own unsigned driver that used its highly privileged kernel access to kill processes and files belonging to endpoint security products. The advanced status of the driver gave it greater ability than other techniques to ensure that the targeted processes are permanently stopped. There are other Windows trusted drivers with known vulnerabilities that could be used in the same way of Gigabyte's drivers. These include signed drivers from VirtualBox, Novell, CPU-Z, and ASUS. And while the Gigabyte driver may be the first known instance of this type of hack, it very well may not be the last, and points to a need for Microsoft to reassess the way their certificate revocation procedures.
Mm. That's tough.
Mm-hmm.
Because the part of me wants to say, oh, we'll just revoke the certificate anytime there's an exploit. But remember that then that would nullify everybody's drivers.
Right. Mm-hmm. So this is almost, I mean, as I'm hearing it, this is like a new wave of Trojan attacks, so to speak.
Yes.
That's what it feels like.
Right.
Like you're coming in through...
trusted
source to get access. Is that not the basic principle behind it? Or is it a whole different way of doing it?
It just feels like, so they're using it as an elevated privilege tactic. So they're using a driver that Windows trusts because of the signature being valid. So it's not a fake driver. It's not like a malware. It is a legitimate driver, but it has a bug in it.
Mm-hmm.
That caused it to be recalled, basically. But the Windows operating system, no matter what version you're running, still trusts the installer for that driver because of the certificate that is applied to it. And so the hackers are using that to then be able to elevate their privileges and do whatever the heck they want.
Right.
And that's the scary thing, because how do you stop that? How can you possibly stop that? I think it comes down to, where's your first line of defense? I think the only thing you have to, that you can look at is, how did they get in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Was it a phishing scam? Was it somebody clicked on an email that had some fileless malware that allowed somebody to run something resident in their computer? Is it that you have remote desktop turned on one of your computers on your network? And that's really easy to hack.
Now, I don't know how certificates work, just because I haven't delved into that. Mm-hmm. But does each certificate and each driver have its own certificate identifier?
No, the driver doesn't have its own certificate, but the company that manufactures the driver does. So that certificate says yes to Microsoft. This is a Gigabyte driver provided by Gigabyte, because it contains the certificate that proves that this is a legitimate driver from Gigabyte.
So what if the certificate system changed in such a way that you have your main certificate, say for Gigabyte, but then you have your sub certificates for each driver rollout, so that it identifies this driver as this subset?
Yeah.
Would that help identify the issue?
A developer, I feel like you're giving me nightmares right now, Jeff.
Oh, okay, fair enough. I'm just trying to think outside the box.
Where you're going, but it just sounds like a logistical nightmare as far as managing those certificates. Like, it could just be a nightmare. I think maybe some kind of an heuristic analysis that is able to identify, maybe it's a checksum that identifies known faulty drivers or deprecated drivers. So that Windows could say, yes, this is a valid certificate. However, Gigabyte has marked this certificate or this installer as bad.
Right.
It's got to be some kind of an identifier.
Yeah. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, do that.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Problem solved.
That's the answer.
Wonderful. Big thanks to Roy W. Nash and our community of viewers for submitting stories to us this week. Thanks for watching the Category5.tv newsroom. Don't forget to like and subscribe for all your tech news with a slight Linux bias. And if you appreciate what we do, become a patron at patreon.com/newsroom. From the Category5.tv newsroom, I'm Sasha Rickman.
And I'm Robbie Ferguson.
And I'm Jeff Weston.